Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Go to patreon.com/chasingearhart to join the chase and become a patron today.
This program contains detailed plot spoilers for the novel Amelia Earhart Unrescued. Listener discretion is advised.
On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
Amelia Earhart was an American aviator who set many flying records and championed the advancement of women in aviation. She became the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean, and the first person to fly solo from Hawaii to the US mainland. During a flight to circumnavigate the globe, Earhart disappeared somewhere over the Pacific in July 1937. Her plane wreckage was never found and she was officially declared lost at sea. Her disappearance was one of the greatest unsolved mysteries of the 20th century. Bones discovered on a Pacific island in 1940 are likely to be those of famed pilot Amelia Earhart. This is according to a US peer-reviewed science journal. Earhart, a plane, and her navigator vanished without a trace in 1937 over the Pacific Ocean. Many theories have sought to explain her disappearance, but a new study published in Forensic Anthropology claims these bones prove she died as an island castaway. The report claims they're a 99% match, contradicting an earlier conclusion. The study was first published by the University of Florida and conducted by Professor Richard Jones from the University of Tennessee. It disputes that the remains found on the eastern Pacific island of Nikumaroro, about 1,800 miles southwest of Hawaii, belong to a man, as a researcher had determined in 1941. Earhart was known to be near the island when she vanished during her doomed attempt to fly across the globe.
Joining me on the podcast tonight is someone who is actually a good friend of the project. He was with us at Atchison during Chasing Earhart, the discussion panel. He's actually our very first three-peat for the project on the podcast. Dr. Tom King is back to talk about Amelia Earhart Unrescued. Dr. King, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast tonight.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We have obviously had you on the show a couple of times. You are our very first guest back a little over a year and a half ago, actually, now. And we actually recently had you back not too long ago with Andrew McKenna for the NICU recap. So we'll avoid the basic starting questions as far as the your professional background, your education. I'm sure everybody's very familiar with that by now. But we're here to talk about something a little different tonight, and this is your new novel, Amelia Earhart Unrescued. And I want to see, instead of asking you about the professional background and education, what I'd like to do is start out this conversation with asking you how this project kind of developed. How did it come across your desk, so to speak?
Well, of course, I've been working on the Earhart Project and on the Nikumaroro study for almost 30 years. And one of the questions that always comes up as we begin to gather these little bits of information and put them together is, does this information make sense? And one way to think about whether it makes sense is, could one conceive of a story in which all this stuff that we find occurs and is created or is put together? And so several years ago, I thought, okay, I'm going to write a novel about the discovery of the bones in 1940 on Nikumaroro and what happened thereafter. And so I did, and couldn't get a publisher for it, of course, so I self-published it. And it's out there on Amazon called 13 Bones. And a number of people who read it said, you really ought to do a prequel and talk about how Amelia actually died on Nikumaroro and what was involved in, producing the assemblages of artifacts and things that we find. And eventually I broke down and did it. And it was a fun project. I basically took all our information, tried to weave it together into a sensible story and have a little bit of fun with it. And that produced Amelia Earhart Unrescued, which was picked up by a very small publisher up in Connecticut, Flat Hammock Press. And so it's out on Amazon and elsewhere now.
And we'll definitely have links to both 13 Bones and Unrescued in tonight's show notes. But I wanted to ask you about, you know, writing these novels that are, of course, not 100% fiction, but there's a fictional aspect to that. As a writer, I mean, you've written a lot of books in your career, but as a writer, is it different? What is the process for you? Did you have to go back and read 13 Bones? Were you familiar enough with your own story there that you wrote in that particular novel to kind of go back and write, okay, this is the prequel, as you mentioned, this is how, you know, this is before 13 Bones, this is how that came to be. Take us through that process as far as, you know, the research, you know, cherry picking from your own research and putting that into the novel.
Well, I mean, I have a pretty good handle on the results of the research to date. And so I didn't have to do a lot of new, well, actually I did have to do a good deal of de novo research because I had to go back and read basically all the Earhart bios and get a better feeling for the social context in which she was operating. I had to do a lot of research into things like popular music of the time because I have her singing and dancing at various times, looking into the natural history of the island. And yes, I, of course, had to check back on 13 Bones every now and then to make sure that I was being consistent and that there wasn't something that had happened in the intervening years that caused me to change my mind. But a lot of it was just imagining myself in Earhart's shoes on Nikumaroro and thinking about what she'd do. It was a very, very interesting getting out of my skin kind of enterprise.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, kind of being in her shoes, so to speak, and thinking about what you do. And I wanted to ask you about that because you have all these aspects, these things you have to fill in. And it's interesting because you guys have done, you know, so much research on this island for so long now, and you're sort of putting together the story as to what you guys think might have happened to Amelia Earhart, or this is most likely would have happened, but you still have holes there that you get to kind of have some fun with and fill in. And I think a lot of that maybe happens to do with Amelia's personality and Fred's personality and, you know, just how they would have been on this island and how Amelia would she have had a fight or flight? You know, how would she have acted on this kind of, in this kind of scenario? So I wanted to ask you about that aspect of it. You know, how fun was that to kind of play with, you know, being in her shoes, so to speak?
Well, it was fun. It was also at times intensely depressing. I mean, you put yourself in the shoes of a very talented, very intelligent, well, an amazing woman who is gradually coming to grips with the fact that she's dying, that she's going to die on this isolated island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and has to grapple with the guilt that she feels over, you know, killing Fred, basically, having taken actions that led to his death, having made a lot of mistakes, having failed to listen to some key advisors about some key things like radio communication, and sort of kicking herself around the island for the things that she had done and not done. Thinking about that and imagining myself in her shoes was sometimes a very depressing enterprise, but at the same time, it was fascinating. And yeah, a lot of fun for me.
Can you go ahead and give us the plot for people who haven't heard you on the show yet, or maybe not? Let's say there's people out there, and there will be people out there that this is their first listen to the show. This is their first introduction to you, and they have no idea what the Nikumaroro hypothesis is. Can you give us the plot of Unrescued, and we'll get into it?
Okay, well, Earhart and Noonan had reached the vicinity of Howland Island and been unable to see it, therefore unable to land on it, and they had then navigated down the so-called line of position, the 157-337 degree line, and the book opens as they actually spot Nikumaroro on the horizon. And they are, of course, intensely grateful to see it because otherwise they're going into the drink. And they circle the island. They are first cheered to see that there's a ship at the island. Somebody's going to be there to rescue them. Then they realize that the ship is wrecked. It's the Norwich City. They don't know that, but it's the freighter Norwich City on the northwest reef of the island. So they circle around and look for a place to land. Tide is low. They land on the reef flat north of the Norwich City wreck. And that's all fine. They land safely. But then as Earhart starts to taxi up to closer to shore, and Noonan is back in the back of the plane getting their raft ready to launch, one of the plane's gears goes down in a hole, and they stop abruptly. Noonan falls over and is injures his head. Long story short, Earhart revives him, treats his wounds, gets him ashore. Meanwhile, they're sitting there in the tropical sun. The plane is turning into an oven. They get out of the plane with a minimum of gear and splash ashore. Amelia settles Fred down under a bush and makes another trip to the plane. Anyway, for the next several days, they are camped there on the northwest shore at the place that we call Camp Zero. And they're going out whenever they can, basically when it's cool enough to get into the plane and when the tide's low and when it's cool enough that they won't cook under the tropical sun, and sending out radio messages. Eventually, however, they have landed at a neap tide when the tide is dead low, and the tide gradually comes back to flood tide, floats the plane off the reef, and it breaks up in the surf zone. At that point, they're stuck. And Amelia is pretty devastated by the loss of her plane, and she's further devastated. She basically caves in, collapses. Fred puts her to bed in the inflatable raft up on the shore. And when she wakes up, Fred has died, presumably of his wounds, and is being eaten by the local crabs, who she fights off and buries Fred's remains, and then is stuck on the island and has to find her way around. She explores the island to see what there is to work with, basically mostly to find water, because she has very little fresh water, just a couple of desert water bags that they brought with them and a thermos. And she then survives for a period of time. I don't know how long she survived, but I have her surviving until basically the day that the British exploring party under Harry Maude lands on the island in early October. That's pure speculation on my part. But she works her way down to eventually what we call the Seven Side at the southeast end of the island, and there she dies. Now, human bones were found at the Seven Side in 1940, and analysis has suggested that they may very well have been those of Amelia Earhart. However, they've disappeared. We haven't yet been able to find them. And so the various things that happen in the novel are things that we have either shown to have happened in the course of years on the island, or they're reasonable speculations.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a good plot, and that's why we're putting the spoiler tag on the front of this. Now, one thing I liked about the novel was sort of the layout of it. At the end of each chapter, you have sources, additional information, and things like that you've kind of weaved into this story, this fictional version of the story that you're telling, this speculative version of the story that you're telling in certain aspects. But I really like that because it's almost got a textbook feel to it in that sense, because it's got, you've got all the sources. So if you want to go back and see what you're talking about on a certain thing, you can go back and dig into the research and look at that. Was that initially was that something you always wanted to do with this novel, or is that something that was just kind of thought about, or how did that come about?
Well, that's something I kicked around with my advisors, and I had a lot of advisors on this book, notably people who have been on the island, particularly women who have been on the island, who know and respect Earhart's memory, and had some really good advice. And we had a lot of correspondence about it. And in various iterations of the novel, I dealt with the background information in different ways. I started out doing them as footnotes, and then I said, nah, you don't want footnotes in a novel. And people told me, just get the damn footnotes out of there. So then I ended up with these chapter end notes that try to explain what the reason is for thinking that she may have done X, Y, Z. And I'm going to be very interested in how people react to it, because I think it does, like you say, it does make it into a kind of a textbook, but I hope a fun textbook, not a boring textbook. And I should say, again, that much of what it's all speculative. It's a novel, for heaven's sake. And already, since its publication, I found some of the things that I have happen apparently did not happen. Some of what we've thought for a long time was the case is not the case. So all I can say is, it's a novel.
Yes, and that's a good way to kind of get away with it, I think, to kind of just have some fun with speculation and you know, have it based off of actual research. But, you know, you can have some liberty there, some creative liberty there, because it is a novel, and it's different than a lot of the stuff that you've previously written. Now, I wanted to ask you, since you just mentioned it, it's a good segue to an email that you sent me several days ago. Regarding John Cada, who, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, who, regarding the sextant box found in 1940, I want you to, rather than me explain it, because I think it'd be much more eloquent if you did, can you talk a little bit about that that correspondence you received and what that changed for you, maybe?
First off, the sextant box was found in 1940 with the bones, that we are told that it was found with the bones. That's the report that Gerald Gallagher, the colonial administrator, sent in. That this sextant box had been found and it had two numbers on it. Tiger's research has strongly suggested that those numbers were U.S. Navy. Well, one was a manufacturer's number, a Brandis manufacturer's number, and the other was a U.S. Navy catalog number, suggesting, of course, that the sextant and the box were the possession of the U.S. Navy. So the idea has been, well, these were sextants that were, sextants, for anybody who doesn't know, is a very important navigational instrument that you use to shoot the sun and figure out where you are in terms of latitude and longitude. And Noonan had one, along with a bubble octant that was the more modern thing for using in airplanes. So we had come to the conclusion, and there was some evidence for it, that this might have been a Navy surplus sextant that was surplus by the Navy at the end of World War I and acquired by Noonan for his own use. And that has been our working hypothesis, that he had the sextant, came ashore with them, Earhart wound up with it, using it as simply a box to hold things. In the novel, I have her holding the pages of her journal in it and carting them around. And in 13 Bones, I have the boys who find the bones find the sextant box with the paper in it and say, oh, what's all this old paper? And throw it away. All speculation. Well, Mr. Cada, I don't know how he pronounces his name either. He's an independent researcher who basically got thrown off the Tiger Forum a while ago for disagreeing with Rick Gillespie. And he has done a great deal of research and I think shown pretty conclusively that the sextant box actually was aboard the USS Bushnell, which visited the island in 1939 to do a survey. And they were using sextants to do their survey. Now, how the box came to be lost, we have no good idea. But it certainly appears to have not been in Amelia Earhart's possession. And so that throws a considerable wrinkle into our whole interpretation of the data.
Now you have a signing for this book coming up in December, I think on the 5th, if I'm not mistaken, down in Los Angeles at one of my favorite bookstores actually I've ever been to. And I want to know if you can talk a little bit about that signing.
Yeah, well, I'll be doing a signing and a reading and a talk at Vroman's bookstore in Pasadena in December. And I haven't yet figured out exactly what I'm going to read. I think I'm going to read the section where the airplane goes off the reef. That's it. I don't have a whole lot more to say about it. It's been set up by my my friend and colleague, Dr. Kimberly Zimmerman, who lives in the area and is an aficionado of the bookstore.
Now, will there be, have you thought about a follow-up book to this? And you have, this is a prequel, so it would really go Amelia Earhart and Rescue, then 13 Bones. Have you ever thought of a follow-up or a third? Trilogies are a hot thing right now and everything. So have you ever thought about that?
I've thought about it. I've thought about maybe trying to do something on how the bones got lost, but I don't have a lot of information on that. It would be highly, highly speculative. And, I've also thought about a sort of alternative history. What would have happened if Earhart had actually been rescued, as I speculate that she almost was? What if she had been rescued? What if she had made it back to the United States? What would have happened then? And I imagine her getting a hero's welcome, being lauded by President Roosevelt, and eventually winding up as the head of the Bureau of Air Commerce, going from that to being the Secretary of Commerce, and being tapped in lieu of Harry Truman as Roosevelt's running mate in 1940 or 44. In which case, of course, she would have become president and would have been the one to make the decision about the dropping of the atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There are all kinds of interesting twists to it, but I'm afraid it would require more of a historian than I am to put together an alternate history like that. So I would encourage somebody else to do it, but I don't think I will.
President Earhart, I like the ring to that. That's kind of nice.
I do too. I think we would have a very, very different world if we had had a President Earhart.
So, yeah, and that was my question. Is you know, and I know that you already answered it. So I mean, I was going to ask you after was you know to speculate a little bit on what you think she would have done if she would have made it off the island. I guess I can ask you this because from a psychological standpoint, just because, you know, being on an island like that, being as traumatic an experience as I imagine that would have been for her, do you think she would have had long lasting, that's probably a silly question to ask, but do you think she would have had long lasting psychological issues with that? You know, being there, being that she witnessed Fred Dyer, that she, like you said earlier in the conversation, she may have, some of the mistakes that she made may have led to Fred's death ultimately. How do you think she would have dealt with that? I mean, what do you think that would have played in her role or in her career after the fact if she had in fact been rescued?
I've speculated about that a little. She was mentally a very strong woman. And I think she would have found ways to cope with it, but I don't think there's any question that it would have had an effect. And, you know, in the novel, I have her engaging in these conversations with coconut crabs or a coconut crab that is talking about how he's going to eat her.
I was hoping you'd bring that up.
Well, and he becomes really her sort of interlocutor. They go through a lot of discussions and they start talking about death and what's going to happen with death and what's going to happen with being eaten by the crabs. Returning to or merging with the island and going on into whatever comes after life. If she had any kind of experiences like that, it couldn't help but influence her, perhaps for the better. So, I don't know, she might have wound up in a loony bin, but on the other hand, it might have been a strengthening and broadening experience.
So I wanted to, before we end the conversation tonight, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your professional career, because there was some news recently that you are no longer associated with TIGER, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. You've been part of that group for so long, and of course, you appeared on this show as a representation of that group the last two times you were on the show, and of course, in Atchison with us several months ago. I wanted to ask you if you'd be willing to discuss, what happened from your point of view. Of course, only say what you're willing to say. No pressure there, but I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on that and then what you're thinking about doing going forward in your career.
Well, I should say that Chasing Earhart doesn't have a whole lot to do with my career. My career is in environmental impact assessment, and I work a lot with Indian tribes and local communities to try to help them save things that are important to them from destruction. So that's my actual career, and I will be continuing to do that until probably I die. In terms of TIGER, you know, TIGER is, despite having a board of directors and so on, is very much a one-man operation. It is put together by Rick Gillespie and his wife, Pat Thrasher, and they continue to operate the organization. Rick and I have long had a sort of testy relationship. When the movie Master and Commander came out, which of course is about the relationship between the Napoleonic era British sea captain Aubrey and his close friend, the doctor and natural philosopher Maturin, Rick described it as Gillespie and King, the early days. And that really is, if you see the movie or read any of the 19 books, the novels about the Aubrey and Maturin, the relationship is not dissimilar. Rick has a sort of military mindset, and there's one guy in charge, and he calls the shots, and you go and do what he says to do, and you capture the objective. I am not very military. I survived 2 years in the Navy, but I am not very much into military ways of thinking. And my ways of thinking are more, if you will, collegial. So Rick and I had a lot of difficulties over the years, and they finally built up to the point where he insisted on my resignation from the board of directors. I declined to resign. Wasn't going to give him that satisfaction. And so he arranged for me to be fired. So I was fired, whereupon they invited me to please stay in Tiger and contribute money. And I said, oh, no, I don't think so. So I left the organization. In terms of the future, I intend to continue to be involved with Earhart Research. I'm still working with National Geographic on its interest in the Nicomororo hypothesis, and will continue to operate my my blog, Amelia Earhart Archaeology. And so I'll continue to be involved with it, but I'm not going to be involved with Tiger.
Dr. King, where can everybody find your new book, Amelia Earhart Unrescued?
Well, Amazon is probably the easiest, or any other major bookseller. It can be gotten through bookstores, but Barnes & Noble, Amazon, etc., that's the easiest thing to do.
Dr. Tom King, folks, this has been a pleasure as always. I really appreciate you stopping by the podcast and chatting with us about your new novel, and we look forward to collaborating with you in the future.
Thank you very much, Chris. Good luck to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Castaway retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart Project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarris Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated, and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.